Welcome to the Abnerdon Podcast, episode 65, a podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
And I'm Jerry.
And in this show, we're going to talk about server migrations,
system admin incidents,
and how we keep on learning.
Right, so we're back again for another episode. So I've migrated my VPS at last, and everything's working on now on a nice Ubuntu 16.04. So I'm guessing I should really maybe look at doing 18.04 to get longer support, but maybe.
It took so long for you to do it that 18.04 came out.
But it's all nice and stable. And people are asking if there's any issues I had with it doing the migration. The only issues I came across really was a couple of them, is that when I moved one of my WordPress sites across, for some reason, when you went to the website to view the page, it just came up with a blank page. It was just completely white, but you could still get into the admin center. So that was a strange one, but it was due to corrupt template. Is it called a template or whatever they're called? The theme of it, sorry.
Yeah, I've often seen that. I think it's been to do with MySQL in the past, and not necessarily WordPress, but I've seen, you know, a white page in the past.
I basically just deleted the template and tried to copy it, or the theme, across again, and it basically didn't work. So I basically just used a different theme and it worked absolutely fine. Then I had a problem with the getting AWS stats to work, because you have to like configure CGI or something for it to auto-generate the pages when you visit them. So I've been using a new system to do the CGI, which I think is called UWSGI. I don't know if you heard of that before.
Is that to do with Python?
Yeah, I think it is. It's the so all of these dynamic handlers for web pages in Apache. PHP's got mod PHP.
PHP FCGI.
Oh yeah, that as well, which you tend to use with Nginx, isn't it? Well, you can use it with
I think it's to do like mod PHP is like one PHP instance for the whole server, and PHP CGI is like a separate process for each V host or something.
Yeah. But yes, there's you've got a Perl one as well, which is mod Perl. You've got, not mod. Is it mod Perl?
I think so, yeah.
You got Passenger for Ruby.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
This UWSGI, which is, as you said, I think the Python one. There's a couple of ways of running Python, isn't there, from memory? Not entirely sure. I don't really run a lot of Python stuff, so.
Yeah, calling it parsed through a socket or something. Anyway, I'll put a link in the show notes how it's a lot easier to configure this version, so it's configured and working.
I should just say, just an on-air errata here. It's WSGI, which is Web Server Gateway Interface. So just so we don't have to correct it next episode.
Fair enough.
The next issue I had as well is that query these AWS stats, like to see the downloads, and I didn't want to lose the archive kind of logs or the archive back of it. I found a way of how you can actually move the logs from one server to the other. So it's actually, you don't actually move the logs, you actually move the old Nginx log files from one server to the other, and then you do a command that basically imports them all back into AWS stats for you. So I'll put a link in the show notes for that as well. And the other issue I had is I use R snapshot or R sync snapshot to back up my configs and all the backups of the websites to a server at home. And I had a load of issues getting the SSH keys to work, but it was just because I wasn't logged on this root. Because when you run the R snapshot, it uses the root account. And because I hadn't switched user to the root account and stored the private key as that user, it was failing. But since I did that, it worked fine. So they were the only kind of main issues I had. But apart from that, it ideally went nice and smoothly. I basically tested my backups to actually transfer the websites from the old server to new. So to actually prove that my backups are working.
That sounds a lot less stressful than than my recent upgrade. It's not in the show notes, so I'm sorry about that, guys. But I decided to upgrade my 1604 home server to run 1804, which is kind of against, it's not against the rules, but it's kind of against the way you're supposed to do it. They tend not to advertise the 1804 upgrade until the 0.1 release comes out, which is usually kind of about 2 to 3 months away. So I ran the upgrade on my 1804 from 1604 to 1804, got halfway through the upgrade process and it said, oh, you've got some virtual machines running in VirtualBox. So I couldn't upgrade VirtualBox. I'm just going to abort everything now for you. Hope that's all right. So you have no option, you know, it's yes or okay sort of thing. I'm like, oh, okay, fair enough. So it backed a load of it out and then it said, I couldn't back out everything. So you might have a non-working system. And I'm like, oh, okay. Fortunately, I've been doing this Linux thing long enough to kind of know how to fix a lot of the issues that came up. So like when it rebooted, it didn't boot properly because there was an issue with the kernel. So I had to go to an earlier kernel from the grub menu. And then it hung halfway through because it hadn't shut down properly. And then I was missing a load of packages, so I had to reinstall all those packages, including, I say it's my server, I run it as a desktop that I tend not to plug a monitor into, so I can VNC into it to do stuff. And yeah, that went, the whole lot just wasn't there. So I had about 3 days, and I have all the stuff that the kids like listen to and most of this, a lot of the stuff that they watch in the house is stored on there. It was just like, oh my God, everything's gone wrong.
They're the most exacting users you'll ever come across to the kids.
Well, fortunately I was able to kind of say, the server's just not working properly at the moment. So, this application's not running and that application's not running. I'll see what I can do whilst I'm, you know, today. Unfortunately was able to get most of it back up and running, but I was just, and the other thing that's come out of the back of it as well is it turns out that my root hard drive is failing as well. I'm getting smart errors that I only spotted when I ran Spinrite from GRC on it. Oh, I had to log a ticket with GRC as well, because if you've got a SATA drive that's big enough, it comes up with a buffer overflow message partway through the run. I was just like, oh.
You won't hear that on security now, the testimonials.
Well, I have to be fair to the guy. I emailed him and sort of said, you know, not him, I emailed the support team and sort of said, you know, what do I do? And their response was, well, actually, all you need to do is go into the BIOS. And the guy came back to me, I think within about 3 hours of me logging it, which obviously he's in the States, so I'm over here. So not too bad turnaround time on that. But yeah, I wasn't best impressed. You have to put it into IDE mode rather than SATA mode, which is a bit weird.
That's all right. He's finished Squirrel now, so he can carry on getting the new version of...
Oh, no, he hasn't finished Squirrel now.
Oh.
He's finished the client. He's now trying to get the forum server up and running, and he's got a couple of tweaks left. Oh.
I don't know. I've only been watching security now for the last, listen, about the last 5 years, and he's always been doing Squirrel since I've known it.
So the copyright notice on the Spinrite 6 shows 2004, I think it is. So that was when he last made any significant changes to Spinrite. Goodness me. Anyway. This was an unscheduled detour. I'm sorry for that. I have learned a lot about running smart on laptops, and I've turned on a load of disk temperature monitors with Monit now as well on my home server. So hopefully I'll start getting alarms about that soon.
I'll just relate my 1804 war story. It's not really a war story. It's just the upgrade went fine on my laptop. Apart from, I can't use the command line SSH agent anymore, which is a bit annoying because it pops up a box every... Well, not. I think it caches it for a while, but when you log into a server using SSH keys, you're asked for your passphrase. And I did have it set just to require the passphrase for the first time, but now it seems to require the passphrase after about 10-15 minutes, which is actually no bad thing in terms of security, but it means that it's all going through the desktop stuff, and I wanted it to go all through the command line and command line SSH agent and so on, and the SSH agent run or supervised by systemd, and that isn't working anymore. But other than that, clean as a whistle, really.
Didn't one of our merry band of Telegram listeners also say they had the same issue?
I think they asked about Seahorse, which I've kind of looked at. I think it's just it's another sort of desktop SSH and GPG agent app, but I haven't had time to look at that yet.
Yeah, so that was one of our amazing listeners, Paul. So So I was going to scroll back through our Telegram session then. I think we'll skip that for now because we're going a bit long on this first section anyway.
So. Yeah. So the other thing I want to talk, if the Windows admins haven't heard of this yet, have a look at the Windows Admin Center. It's a web interface of how you can manage your servers through a web interface. So like if you like RDP onto a server and you can go to your event viewer, look at the perfmom, look at your disks, you can all now do that through a web page. So it's a bit like Webmin, which you used to get. I think you can still get Webmin, can't you?
Mm.
But it's all in one place now. It's a really cool little tool to have a look at. And it's free. And it's supported on Windows 2012 R2 and Windows 2016. So have a look at it.
Microsoft are getting better at this sort of thing. I'm on the job market again. And I've heard recruiters tell me that Windows is kind of, you know, Windows Server, Windows DevOps, air quotes, is kind of what people are looking for these days. So, yeah, just something to bear in mind if anyone's looking, because the money's pretty good.
Oh, so I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page about Project Honolulu, which apparently it only got named that, it was known as that before April 2018, so...
I think they should keep these code names because Windows 95 should have been called Chicago. I think that would have been a much better name for an operating system.
Yeah, but that's because we come from the Linux world and, you know, we have things like Bionic.
I first heard about this at a Microsoft conference about 6 months ago. And, yeah, they literally just renamed it to the Admin Center and released it out of beta about a month ago. So,
but, I mean, the kind of... The techies that are running this, like, I think they prefer the code names. You know, they rename this thing, and you end up with some kind of focus group thing like Windows Small Business Server Essentials or something like that. It doesn't make any sense. Just to mention as well, admin panels. If anyone has seen it, Cockpit is a Red Hat thing. Which seems pretty good. I saw a talk on it at Fosdem, and it looks really good. So I haven't tried it myself, but might be something to look at.
We've always kind of said about how I always kind of, if you're running Linux or whatever, in a production environment, that it's always nice to have vendor support. And there is an episode on the Answers Admin podcast, episode 35, which is called Don't Be Like Nate, where he kind of had a bad day in the office. I think it took him about a month to fix it. It's episode 35. We'll put a link in the show. John, I think you're best one to describe what had happened because he was kind of what had actually happened. I don't have they use Red Hat virtualization KVM, don't they?
So it sounds like you said, they use the Red Hat virtualization KVM, and that kind of has a require, you basically got like almost like an orchestration machine, so that's the one that can control all of the rest of the fleet of machines, and he was, from memory, I think he was trying to do an upgrade of he was trying to DD a file.
No, he'd learnt to go onto a console of one of the Linux machines he was trying to manage, and he couldn't get onto it. And when that happens, it's normally the disk had filled up. So he went onto the server, which was hosting, because that was the virtual machine as well.
Mm.
So he went onto that server, And apparently to add an extra disk in, you have to DD.
Oh, yeah.
He has to DD a file to create the extra hard drive, but he didn't create a new hard drive. He DD'd over the existing hard drive.
So he overwrote the first sort of 200 or 300 meg, which incidentally, he realised what he'd done was control C-ing. Now, I don't know whether he uses a thing called Mosh, but Mosh prioritises control C specifically for situations like this. So he was running control C, he was type hitting control C, and he overwrote the first couple of hundred meg of the OS, which obviously most of the OS isn't in there. But what is there is your boot partition and the first few files on the OS. So to get that fixed, he'd have needed to done a reinstall, which would have meant doing a reboot. If he did a reboot, he would have potentially lost data because he wouldn't have been able to get access to this machine remotely. So he'd have potentially lost all of the control of this estate. He was in a rush because he wanted to go and see a friend. So he copies like some of the data off onto another machine, goes away to look at when he gets home and goes, ah, the backups that I've just taken away from with me from site or from the customer site, the data's not right in there. And basically the previous, like, further back through his logs than he had retained logs for, the backups had been failing, and so he'd lost all his backup rotation of backups. And he's like, oh, it's fine because I've got this other backup system, and then discovered that the command that was executing hadn't run or was backing up the wrong part of the disk or something. So he ended up with, he's away from site, he's lost part of his hard disk, he's got no backups. I think from the sounds of things, it was difficult to get back to site or something like that, so he couldn't get back to site either. And he said sort of 2 weeks later he was still recovering data, I think, with the help of the vendor.
Yeah, because I couldn't understand that, is that it looked like this machine had controls the whole infrastructure. But if you lose that, then he'd literally, it was like he had to copy the VMs from one place to another place to then get it to a new cluster, is what I understand listening to.
Yeah.
But I don't know much about KVM kind of thing, so I don't know how it works. But I mean, with the VMware, he was asking, like, how does it work in VMware and Hyper-V? Is that in VMware, you have the host, the same thing in Hyper-V, is you have the host, which is basically the standalone server, which hosts the VMs. So if you ever lose, like, the vCenter or your SCCM, you can still connect to that host and then control those VMs directly. Or if you lost your vCenter, it's a bit of a nightmare, but you can disjoin that current host, EXE or iHost, from the existing cluster and add it into a new cluster. So it was just it just shows you that it's good because you've got someone, if you've got a vendor support, they know that product inside out, where it's always nice to have that kind of that backing.
So what was this vendor? Was it VMware or was it the storage?
It was Red Hat.
Oh, okay.
So it's Red Hat's virtualization product.
Oh, okay.
And like Al said, if you lost the control machine, the VMs would keep running. But if you somehow lost the connection between your control machine and the back servers, if you rebuilt it, you wouldn't be able to control them anymore. And I'm guessing it must be something like SSL certificates or something like that.
So you basically had to create a new cluster, copy all the VHD or whatever the file is, and to a new platform with the help of the vendor, kind of thing.
Well, I mean, I guess being Red Hat, unless it's because they do have these kind of proprietary things like Satellite and that kind of thing. Bastion, I think Bastion is another one. Where I'm not sure if there's some proprietary part in there, but if it is all open source, you can. You know, if you have the skills, you can go in and look at the code and see what it's doing and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but if it's 2 o'clock in the morning,
oh yeah,
or you've had what my father used to refer to affectionately as a brown trouser moment. You know, if you've got one of these situations where everything's gone wrong, particularly if you're not necessarily a lone engineer, but, you know, if it's a small team, sort of 10, 20, 30 people, you know, you may not necessarily have the resources to be going around and doing this stuff all yourself, or spending, you know, 3 days reading through source code to figure out how to make it work.
I mean, I've heard that Red Hat have always been really good at this. I think they started charging for their Red Hat workstation, you know, many years ago. And I heard from, or I read an article or something about someone that had phoned their support line and just got someone on the end of the phone, and they worked through the problem, completely fixed it. And they were just checking that everything was okay before hanging up. You know, you basically call a number and someone answers, a techie answers that can solve your problem from beginning to end, basically. So I assume they've kind of maintained that that kind of support ethos all the way through.
And that was kind of the thing I was trying to, on that episode we did at Odd Camp with Martin Wimpress, is that was what I was trying to get to him. That, yeah, if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and it's only you and it's, yeah, and it's problem, then it's always good to have the vendor support.
Yeah, because who else are you going to call? No one else is going to want to be woken up.
But then again, this is why, you know, to a certain extent, your larger support people, so you know, you as, and this kind of harks back to when Andy used to be with us, you know, Andy wouldn't necessarily have a support contract with a Red Hat, Microsoft, whomever. Whereas when you get to the larger organizations, like, you know, the sort of 30-man team, 40-man team, or if you're hosting large amounts of data, you know, or you've got like significant commercial contracts with people, that's when you tend to, you extend on from where you would, you know, you're not doing it yourself. It's not a personal risk to your business. It's now, you know, you can pass some of that risk on to another party, you know, so you might have, it's basically just outsourcing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, at what point is your support risk greater than the cost of outsourcing that support to someone else?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to a cost benefit analysis, doesn't it? So, I mean, if you're looking after that sort of scale of infrastructure and data and so on, you're probably charging your client quite a lot. So therefore, you can afford the Red Hat subscription, and you know, that's all fine. And I think Red Hat probably pitch at a level that it's not, I mean, it's, you know, thousands of pounds, but that's really, if you're charging your client, you know, tens of thousands of pounds, that's, it's worth it.
Yeah. But yeah, so, I mean, the other thing as well that I took from the don't be like Nate thing is, you know, a backup is only as good as the last time you checked your backup. So for all of our admins who are listening to this, if you're running backups, probably worth just reminding yourself how you restore a backup and checking to make sure your backups are all valid. You don't need to restore a backup to the same system it's on necessarily, particularly if you've got, you know, if you're particularly working in cloud stuff like, you know, the three of us are more likely to, you know, but if you've got, you know, physical hardware you can restore backups onto, probably worth trying to restore a backup just to confirm your backups are working.
I'd also say, we were talking about our snapshot earlier. I've been using that for years and it's always been reliable, I think mainly due to the way our sync works. But I've recently been looking at Duplicity, because a lot of the reason for that is because it will verify the backup. So I guess it will be checking checksum of what it's expecting to see against what the actual backup is. So you can get a fairly good idea of whether the backup actually works or not to a remote destination. So and plus it's easier. I think it's probably easier to restore from Duplicity as well. Our snapshot, because of the way you're I think you're pulling data it's by its nature, it's harder to go the other way and restore.
Right.
I've found, personally.
So I'm quite fortunate in that my personal stuff, I've never had to recover like that. And I'm saying that in full knowledge of what I was saying before about the VM that nearly was a box before. Fortunately, I follow the 3-2-1 process where you've got three backups, two of which on two different mediums, one of which is offsite. Most of the stuff that I'm keeping is photos that, my wife and I have taken when it comes to stuff like that. So it's quite easy for me to have, a local copy on my phone, a copy on my server, and then a backup in the cloud on something. So, but yes, it is very easy for things to go drastically wrong quite quickly if you haven't got backups there. So,
yeah, but I did feel for Nate though, listening to the episode, and yeah, it sounded like he had a very stressful month.
I did have a similar thing where I deleted, using Puppet, I deleted about 10 terabytes of data from an organisation. I don't know if I've ever talked about this on the show, but...
I think you have mentioned it, little bit, but gone into it too much.
So I learned a lot about the backups, they were really comprehensive, but the way they were done, it just took a lot of time to recover. I won't go into the gory details right now. But it was probably about a month before everything was back and up and running and so on. And my name was Mud.
See, that's worrying, really, because the post-mortem after the GitLab disaster a little while back, they made it quite, I'd almost go as far as to say abundantly clear that everyone can make a mistake.
Mm.
To the extent that the guy, I think, is now making a career of going around to conferences and saying, I'm the guy that took down all the GitLab services. The thing that sets you apart is how you react to that issue.
Mm.
And it's the same with coding, with bugs, with, security vulnerabilities. It should be the same across the piece. If you've caused something, there's no point in getting cross, it's a failure of one in three things. It's either a process failure, you shouldn't have been doing that thing at that time. It's an understanding failure, I thought that when you clicked on the left button, it made it do this thing. Instead, you had to click on the right button. Well, you can't shout at someone for that because that's a comprehension thing.
Yeah, yeah. Or documentation.
Or training, And the last thing is, we're all human. Sometimes people just make mistakes, and you need to have something in place that's, to cope with issues like this.
Yeah.
There's a reason that, most highly resilient solutions have got multiple bits of hardware, multiple data centers, multiple environments. You have this redundancy there. So that if something goes wrong, it doesn't take your whole environment out.
Yeah.
If you've not got that redundancy there, there's a problem in your processes somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, there is this idea of resilience and anti-fragility, I think it's sort of phrase was coined. And it applies, not just IT, but, society in general and, the infrastructure in terms of, roads and that kind of thing. You can apply it to lots of distributed complex systems, not just IT. But yeah, I mean, I got put through the whole disciplinary process at work, which wasn't fun, but that's the way they decided to play it. So, but it's a lesson learned. It's definitely, I think probably every admin goes through it at some point. It's just, was particularly visible in my case, but never mind. I'm not going to do it again.
Well, the lesson learned then.
Yeah.
So moving on then, John, you wanted to talk about, learning, isn't it? Or keep on top of learning.
So one of the things that I've found since I've started working from home is that it's because you don't tend to bounce ideas off people so much. I've found that I need to be a lot more aggressive in keeping myself up to speed with stuff. And part of the way that I do that, I used to listen to an awful lot of podcasts when I was traveling to and from work. Obviously, I don't get to listen to quite so many podcasts anymore. But if anyone wants to know my list of podcasts, I can provide that to people as well. But the other thing that I do is I get a lot of email newsletters. Now, I don't try and read all of them, but I subscribe to 14 different email newsletters that usually come out sort of weekly or two weekly. And I thought what I might do is actually go through a few of these lists that I get on a regular basis and just kind of explain why I get them and where they might be useful to other people. There's also some other resources that I read as well. So I'm on RSS. I get RSS feeds from a handful of technology sources. To be fair, a lot less sites I tend to get a lot less content through RSS feeds versus these sort of curated mailing lists, because the curated mailing lists are curated, so people have elected to put content into those mailing lists. And the last thing that I do is I tend to be on a lot of different chat systems, mostly just to lurk and see what people are talking about. It's almost like my equivalent of the water cooler, to use an Americanism, you know, that kind of listening to what other people are doing to learn for yourself. So what I'll do is I'll quickly scan through the list of things that I subscribe to. So the mailing lists, I am on a mailing list called Cron Weekly, which is about server administration, and DevOps Weekly.
Actually, before you carry on, I should say that this is more of a newsletter, so it's like a weekly newsletter or a fortnightly newsletter rather than an actual mailing list.
Sorry, that's a good point. Yeah, so the mailing lists that I mentioned before, they're newsletter mailing lists rather than more like broadcasts. Yeah, okay. So these are broadcasts of curated lists. I'm also on content mailing lists, but most of those, it's quite difficult to pull the nuggets of interesting content out of.
Signal to noise ratio is high.
Yes.
Or low.
particularly around, it's low. Particularly around stuff like security and cryptography, there's a lot of noise and not always necessarily a lot of signal, which is a shame. But I still like watching the cryptography and security mailing lists anyway, just because it's fun. I get Cron Weekly, which is about server administration, particularly Linux and Unix servers, but there's other bits and pieces as well. DevOps Weekly, which was actually where I got into reading a lot of these different mailing lists, because it was a very early one that started.
I subscribe to that. And just to point out, the Arrested DevOps, they had the guy Gareth Rushgrove on there talking about that, particularly DevOps Weekly, so that's probably worth a listen.
So I actually worked with Gareth on a project for a little while, whilst he was still at gov.uk, which is I picked up the maintenance of the vagrantbox.es website from him, which was a project he started.
Right.
So that's kind of how I found out about DevOps Weekly, was because of some... Anyway, so yeah, so DevOps Weekly is about DevOps tools and... processes and not processes, but like community stuff to do with agile working and, you know, picking up the DevOps mentality.
Also, there's quite a bit of sort of tech, the tech side of things as well. Articles about the tech side of things, and there's always like a tools section, like the tools that people have written and so on.
I also read DevOps-ish, which is similar content from somebody else.
I think I'd like that one. I'm DevOps-ish.
I get Monitoring Weekly and SRE Weekly. So SRE is the Site Reliability Engineers, which is a term that Google coined. So it's not just operations and DevOps-style working, but it's also kind of a more... Part of the reason why Google hires these SREs rather than engineers is because... an SRE in theory is supposed to be able to solve all the, well, I'm still trying to get my head around the different terminology differences, but an SRE is basically somebody that does a lot more with the server. So they'll be more aware of kernel intricacies and programming intricacies, as well as, so they're more like the sort of person that would work for, say, for example, a Red Hat or someone like that.
I've seen that term applied more to the sort of monitoring side of things. So these days, you know, someone that's watching metrics or trying to glean stuff from metrics and, I suppose, fix things before they happen.
All right, okay.
So, you know, I'm obviously, being a contractor, I'm looking around for jobs all the time, mainly looking at DevOps engineer type stuff, but one of the ones I came across, they would say, oh, we're looking for some SRE skills. So I was like, what is that? And it turned out they were thinking more of the monitoring side of things and monitoring and metrics and that side of things.
Yeah, right, okay.
I guess that's how you make decisions about whether your site is reliable or not, or whether it's going to be reliable in the future.
Yeah, so it's more about kind of building in your metrics and your logging and your... So I guess it's more around the application side of...
Yeah.
So it's more around the dev side of DevOps than the ops side of DevOps, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. But still being able to do the ops side of things.
Yeah.
So what else do I get? Servers for Hackers, which is kind of server administration guides for people that are coders. That's quite good. And it's, there's also a book done by the same person that curates that list. I get the security newsletter, which is a weekly newsletter just covering kind of what's happened in the security world. So things like the eFail stuff that was announced this week, those sorts of things would be in there. I also get the Awesome Self-Hosting newsletter, which is basically here are some projects you might be interested in hosting in your own environment. And the Raspberry Pi Weekly, basically just because Raspberry Pis are usually got cool projects running on them, although not necessarily got the time to do any of them. For a bit more kind of less focused on technology side of things, I follow Versioning, which is about kind of web design and sort of front-end web design. So it's less about kind of running servers and maintaining service and more about kind of how you develop applications and kind of how things look. So it's more UI, UX and coding than necessarily ops, which is more where I historically looked at. And I get The Hustle, which is about business. So it's kind of saying, you know, this is a company that has just bought someone else's product, firm, or this is somebody that's being taken to court for something. So it's less about technology and more about business. And then I get one completely random one, which is the Andy Bounds Tuesday Tip, which is about selling. And it's mostly about how to give presentations or kind of engage in marketing, which if you are good at operations or you're good at programming, if you can't speak business, those skills are not very useful to you, or less, that they're less useful to you than somebody who can also speak business as well.
I'm just sort of coming around to that point of view, but maybe we'll talk, we'll go through your stuff and then maybe talk about that in a minute.
That's the mailing lists that I subscribe to. I've stuck all mine in there. Are there any other mailing lists that you guys get that kind of might benefit people as well?
I'm only subscribed to DevOps Weekly and SRE Weekly at the moment, but I've actually gone through, as you've been talking, and subscribed to a lot of the others. So.
Oh, right. Okay. Excellent.
So the one I have every week, which is a bit awkward to get, is The Word from Gushoff. So he's the main technical guy at Veeam. And if you do a lot with Veeam, you can be on their forum if you post a question on there. But you get a weekly digest. And on the weekly digest, this top guy writes about five paragraphs of interesting things. So I found like those little bugs out from that, or little tips about Veeam, or even things like VMware. Because the newest version of VMware is like 6.7, and they've changed the whole way they do the backups, which has like really put Veeam in a situation where they've got to redevelop how they do all their work. And they're basically backporting that to 6.5 update 2. So they don't recommend you upgrade to update 2 yet because their Veeam won't work. So like if you didn't have that newsletter, you wouldn't know that. So yeah, it's quite interesting because I always like look forward to reading that because that always comes out late Sunday night. So it's my first read of the day when I'm in the office on the Monday morning.
It's often hard to remember, easy to forget that it's a constantly moving target. Software is constantly changing.
Mm.
And when it comes to the stuff that we do, it's the software that runs the other software, the software that is kind of the businesses, make the businesses money. So it's really important to keep up to date with it.
This is what I was talking to my life coach about. I mean, if you're like a builder or something, or like a plumber, I mean, it's not a lot what changes week in, week out. There might be a new radiator come out or something every month or something, or you get a new, but it's just so hard to keep on top of it. And the problem I get, I don't know if you guys get it, with having young children, is getting the time
to
learn all this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the way if younger ones, you know, we're ever having a family, you've got the time to do it, but probably out partying anyway. But what I'm finding is a lot of the time is that if I'm doing a lot of pre-sales work, I'm learning the product as I'm doing the pre-sales stuff. And that's where I have to pick it up. Like, I didn't know much about SQL mirroring the other day, and now I know my inside out. And I'm doing SharePoint migration, I know that inside out, but it's only because I had to sit down.
The thing is, if you have to do it for a client, you know, then you learn it extra quick. If you have to learn it on the job, then you learn it extra quick. And to be honest, that's the way I always learn stuff, is on the job. So.
And that's how I like to do it. And I take my time. I'm not rushing it. I tell you, my boss will know that. He knows that he wants it done to best practice, and he knows that don't rush it. If I'm going to need more time for it, let me know. We're going to bill him for whatever. You need to do it properly, kind of thing. But that's what I was asking if you had any tips or anything, because I find it really hard to focus. If I've been working all day, the last thing I want to be doing is getting my head in another newsletter when I get home.
One thing that I wanted to mention is it is quite hard to, if you're listening to lots of podcasts or lots of tech podcasts and so on about this kind of stuff, or maybe other podcasts because you just want to chill out, it's hard to read newsletters while you're doing that. So there's a bit of a conflict in my, the way that I consume content, I suppose, between reading stuff and listening to podcasts about stuff. I suppose listening to podcasts is more like entertainment in some ways.
And again, so that's the way I like listening to podcasts, watching videos, YouTube, because that's how I can do it. Because if I read it, my brain just starts wandering across the page, and I find it really hard. And that's why I kind of, probably like why I like Windows more than Linux, because of it's just my way my brain works, kind of thing. Like reading, like what's the thing where you can read the man pages or whatever?
So, yeah.
I actually read a man page the other day, and it actually fixed my problem. So Googling didn't actually fix it.
You're taking your first step into a larger world.
Because it's basically AWS Stats. It's R Snapshot. I wanted a daily report of the R Snapshot, and there's a .pll file you need to run scheduling in the next... In the cron, yeah. And I was Googling it and no one was saying it. So I went into the man page and it told you exactly in the man page what I wanted to do.
The thing that I tend to look up in man pages is the option, so minus whatever. Yeah, and you can just do a search for that. And sometimes at the bottom they have examples, and those are the best man pages because they actually show you how to use the command. So
there is something that I've found. That I've found recently as well, which is a project called TLDR, which is I found it as a snap package. for Ubuntu. And with that, it's like a curator, a shortened version of man pages.
Right.
So like, for example, if I type in TLDR tar, for example, it goes away, checks to make sure I've got the latest version of the TLDR data. And then it gives you, you know, here are sort of seven frequently used commands with tar.
It's on GitHub as well. I've just Googled it.
Do you know what TLDR stands for?
Too long, didn't read. Yes, very much so. Very much so.
They're missing a semicolon, but I can see that how that could screw up coding and stuff.
Going back to reading that one about, you said there's a newsletter which kind of does the business kind of thing. There's two podcasts I would recommend people listening to. One is the Minimalist podcast, which is very good. If you haven't watched the documentary on Netflix, watch it. It's really...
What's it called? The Minimalist?
Yeah. So it's basically people who live on a minimal life. They like don't have much stuff. But it's also a philosophy. Like you're going on about, John was going on about earlier about if you make a mistake, don't worry about it kind of thing. We all make mistakes. There's no kind of being sad over spilt milk or whatever. It's all about mindfulness and stuff.
That's always useful.
So it's a really good little podcast. This is about an hour. I'm looking up on my podcast list to see what the other one is you should listen to. So anyway, fill some time, someone else, while I find it.
Well, I was going to say, so the thing that I tend to do, you were saying before about you find it quite difficult to pass through text, kind of particularly if you get distracted by something else. So I do a couple of things with this. The first is I use an RSS reader called Tiny RSS, which you can... There's a plugin, not plugin, something that it will do, which is where it'll actually... You can publish links out of it. So I tend to use that Tiny RSS published list as kind of like a... I've scanned through 6 or 10 or 50 or whatever, however many newsletter things that I've got time to read at that time. And I just open all the things that I'm interested in and then paste them into this tiny RSS thing. And then that then means that I've got a reference back to these web pages, these links that are quite useful to me. And also, I mentioned before as well that I read a few RSS feeds. So again, if something comes up in one of those RSS feeds that's useful, I will share it through that as well. And I then have a if this then that task that links those entries that are in tiny RSS back to my blog to say, I found this, I think this might be useful to you. And it basically, in fact, if you look at my recent blog posts, there's about 3 or 4 of them in there which say, this was automatically posted from my RSS reader. It may be edited later to add some context to it, which it might not as well. But so if it's in there, it just says that, means I found this, I thought it was interesting. And if it doesn't say anything, that means I need to go back and have a look at why this is useful at some point.
Right.
So that's my workflow for these things, especially seeing as Al was mentioning before about getting a bit lost in kind of what to do with all this content.
That's why I have my Kindle, because I can read better on my Kindle more than reading actual books.
That's true as well. You can send, you can set up, like you were saying, John, IFTTT, you can send just to your email address that your Kindle automatically gets. So something like, if you, you can do, you save something to Pocket, for instance, from directly from Firefox as it's integrated, and then that article can get automatically sent to you to mm-hmm. your Kindle address. So, yeah, that's a great way to have stuff there, easy to read and so on.
To be fair, my Kindle is only really used for fiction stuff if I start trying to put technical stuff in there. So I've got... I went through a spate of getting all of the... So PAX Publications... have a daily free book, which I was going to mention as well. It's worth just sort of keeping an eye on what those are. And I went through a spate of getting every one of those that was even remotely interesting. So I now have 130 of these packed free books. And there was a few others that I got on Humble Bundles and stuff like that as well. And what I found was that I'd start reading those. And like Al was saying before about how he gets with these newsletters, I would get more than, like, I would get like 15 pages, 20 pages into the Kindle book, and I'd just be like, too long, can't read, archive it. And, you know, I might pick it up, you know, I might scan for it later. But actually what I tend to find is that books don't tend to be that useful to me, because the content, whilst it doesn't go out of date necessarily, what you tend to find is books online tend to be easier to use. Not books, but like RSS, blog posts and stuff like that. Short form content is easier for me to pass than long form content.
I mean, if in the unlikely event you ever have, you know, more than about half an hour, three quarters of an hour, then long form is good.
Well, I mean, you say that, but what I tend to find, so everyone learns differently. It's a well-known, well-understood fact that everyone learns differently. And I personally tend to find that long-form books, whilst I have a large collection of them, if they're not fiction and therefore exciting and everything's changing, I tend to lose interest. So the one long-form technical book that I've read that held my interest was The Phoenix Project in the last 5 years. That's probably the only one that's actually held my interest. And that's because it's written as a fiction book. Even though it's talking about technical issues, it's a fiction book.
I mean, the technical books tend to be collections of articles anyway, really. There might be some sort of ongoing narrative through it, sort of developing something from really basic to more advanced, but it does tend to be, I know that, I mean, the first time I ever used a technical book like that was with 3D Studio in the sort of mid-90s. And we did kind of use it as a more of a reference thing. It's like, you know, we wanted to get this one thing done. We look at this chapter of the book or whatever. And then you can sort of read more into it. There's more context around things and with a book. But you know, you often get the same thing from a series of articles on Medium, for instance. There's a lot of good content on Medium I've found recently with the sort of DevOps stuff that I'm doing.
So the couple of bits and pieces that are like RSS feeds that I tend to follow are the SysAdvent, which is 25 days a year. It's a good RSS feed to have, though, because you tend to forget that it's there.
Yeah, that's really good. And then it suddenly makes an appearance in your RSS reader every December.
There were two others, but I don't remember having read those recently. One, which is How I Automate, and the other one, which is Free Tech Books, which again comes back to that packed daily free book that I was talking about before. And then I'm in chat rooms for All Day DevOps, which is a yearly online conference. And there's loads of different operations style chat topics on Slack from that. There's also what used to be a YouTube series called HangOps. There's a Slack service for that I'm on. And then being in the northwest of the UK, I'm in the Manchester Tech Slack community. So those are all different places where you can ask kind of different questions about technology. So the Manchester Tech stuff tends to be a lot more about front-end development, web development, testing community, stuff like that. All-day DevOps is tending to be, you know, specific technology, new user-ish content, really, more than anything else. And then HangOps is more kind of the old grizzled greybeards of sort of the technology world, sort of asking, you know, what's the difference between this feature in Red Hat versus that feature in Ubuntu or something like that? Those sorts of questions, which are, you know, genuinely quite good content. So that's what I tend to do to sort of keep learning in between, you know, working hours. I don't know whether any of the stuff there that I've said resonates with either of you guys, kind of as to how you keep on top of, you know, this moving target, which is the IT industry.
Yeah, I mean, I mainly just listen to podcasts is what I try and keep up to date with, and just try and keep on top of the buzzwords, really, trying to, so that if someone asks me, I know what they're talking about. because I mean, a couple of years ago, I went to a site and they were talking about AWS and they were talking about, I can't remember the way they worked and stuff. I don't know what they're talking about now. I know, listen to podcasts, they know about all that kind of stuff, talking to Jerry and stuff.
I mean, I listen to or read, I read a lot less than you do, John, but I think I pick up a bit from podcasts. Not so much recently, but in the past, Floss Weekly on the Twit Network. That's where I first heard about Puppet and where I first heard about Ansible. So I've got Floss Weekly to thank for that. There hasn't been a lot recently that I've been that interested in, but I think that's just, you know, my interests are becoming more focused, and maybe, I don't know, maybe the content is becoming less focused. I don't know. It's not a criticism of it, but just the, there was a period where my interests and the topics matched up, and now they don't so much. And really, yeah, just keep, I mean, day to day, the really important stuff to know about for me is the sort of big security vulnerabilities, I suppose. It's always good to know about that as and when it's happening and how that's shaping up. Security Now is really good for that, I find, because whatever you think about Steve Gibson, he does know what he's talking about, or knows how to drill down into, you know, how something is working or how it's not working.
Mm.
So that's always a good source for me, and always pretty well up to date as well.
So I tend to find more that the content that I'm getting from Steve Gibson, I see where you're coming from. And a while ago, I would have absolutely wholeheartedly agreed with you on that. The problem that I think I'm starting to have with Steve Gibson is that he's very easily blown away by the hype of something. So something's blowing up on Twitter or Facebook, or not Facebook, you know, Twitter or Hacker News or something like that. He'll jump on it and he'll follow that as a subject far beyond kind of where it's actually relevant to stay on top of.
Yeah.
And I tend to find that the Risky Business podcast is a lot better at covering security news in a much shorter form of podcast with a lot less
hype.
It's not just hype, a lot less self. It's a lot less about the individual. So Steve, like, for example, one of the things that I find a bit frustrating about Security Now is that Leo clearly doesn't really know that much about the stuff that Steve's talking about. He's got an inkling and he'll know the buzzwords, but he's not really plugged into the security world anymore. Or if he was, I mean, he must have been at one point, but not so much. And Steve is not a security professional. He's a programmer. So his interest in stuff is around the whys and hows of how the security things have happened, rather than necessarily about the whys and hows they're important to people, if that makes sense. So this is why I find Risky Business a much better podcast, because it's done by a security journalist who's been doing journalism for, I think, 15 to 20 years. Used to work for Computer Weekly and people like that. So he's got the journalist head on, and he's got the contacts in places to go and ask questions about security matters. And then he has, as his sort of foil, his counterpart, when they review in the news, he usually has somebody who is a security professional pen tester who does what we call red team engagement. So he's actively attempting to breach environments. So when someone's talking about, you know, this is a major vulnerability because, you know, if left in the wrong configuration, somebody can access your server, Steve Gibson potentially might go, the sky is falling, you know, I'll never install Windows as a result of this or whatever it is Steve's rant is on about that week. Whereas this guy will say, actually, you know what? Whilst, yes, it is important to patch that, here's three other vulnerabilities that were also released at the same time that are actually more important to you because these are actually targets that might come to you. And that's the nuanced difference between security now, which I still listen to and is still relevant, but Risky Business is a much better view of how business looks at security.
I haven't heard of that Risky Business before. I'll have to have a check it out. I mean, the thing I like about Steve Gibson, the way he explains stuff is quite good.
Yeah, I was going to say that. It's the kind of deep dive stuff. I appreciate it more for that than the security news because, yeah, I kind of get what you're saying about that.
But I have noticed that he has been... I haven't been concentrating that much when I'm listening to him now on his podcast. It does seem to be getting more and more on his high horse kind of thing. What's the other podcast, the security one you were recommending, John? Is it on the list which we talk about?
Defensive Security.
Is that the one with the two guys in it who go, they always start going, these opinions are not ours kind of thing?
Yes. So Defensive Security is two guys that have been, again, in security for quite a long while. And they're what we call blue team people, so they're defenders. And one of them is now a chief security officer for a large solutions integrator. I think I know which one it is, but I'm not going to mention them just in case I got the wrong one. And I don't know what the other guy does, but they've clearly worked together at some point in the past. So their schedule is a bit less regular.
Yes.
So, you know, it might be like there might be 3 weeks where they've got a podcast every week, and then there might be a month when they don't get a podcast out at all. And it's because this guy's flying all over the world with his job. So he never knows exactly where he's going to be from one week to the next, which, you know, is fine. They're a lot more sarcastic and a lot less polished than the more journalistic podcast that is Risky Business. And they're a lot more likely to kind of do the audio equivalent of an eye roll at something that doesn't necessarily, you know, isn't. Like, they'll talk about dumpster fires and stuff like that a lot more. There's a lot more in-jokes in defensive security. But, you know, genuinely, I think I would be glad to meet these guys in a pub and have a few drinks with them, which I think I'd probably feel a bit out of place doing that with Steve Gibbs. Steve Gibson, if I'm honest with you. But never mind.
Okay, that's added to my Risky Business, added to my podcast list as we speak.
Yeah, I've done that as
excellent.
Well.
So the other thing about Risky Business, as well as it being a news podcast, not that I'm wishing to plug, you know, everyone else's podcasts, but I think I do, is they tend to have like a news piece, which is about a third of the show. They have a vendor piece at the end, which is like a third of the show. And then they have a piece in the middle, which is just like a, you know, a subject's come up this week, this month. I saw this person talking about something at a conference or whatever, and it was really good. So I've brought them onto the show to talk about that thing. And that's really good. Yeah. So it's like the equivalent of the deep dive, but it's about stuff that's actually security related.
Yeah. That's a bit like Arrested DevOps. They kind of have those guests.
Yes.
They're sort of big names in DevOps world and stuff.
Mm. For some reason, I struggle a bit with Arrested DevOps. I'm not sure why, but they do tend to kind of be lower in my priority list of podcasts than some of the others.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The podcast I was talking about is called Brendan.com. It's the one I was talking about earlier.
Not come across that one yet, so I think that's going onto my podcast list. Excellent. We've all traded new content to read.
Yeah, the Brendan.com is more of a like a life coach kind of thing about telling you how to do different things and thinking about life in a different way. So that's quite good. The other one is Darknet Diaries you've got on the list, which is quite good. There's a quite interesting one about the other day, the lightest one about how how to decrypt either the Blu-rays or the high definition disc or whatever. So that's quite interesting.
That's more of a story. It's kind of it's almost like a journalist's explaining something to you, almost.
It's like a Wired magazine article.
Yeah.
So the reason that guy that podcast got started, from what I remember, is the guy was going to a lot of security conferences and was seeing talks and wanted to find out more about the stories behind the talks. So he started doing this podcast to basically bring the stories out of just, you know, a guy standing on stage and into being actual content that could be delivered and would be engaging. I think it takes up quite a lot of his time, so he's not releasing them that often. But yeah, it's a really good podcast to listen to and to kind of... It's not necessarily a technical podcast, it's a story podcast.
But it's kind of technical enough that if you're in, you know, that way inclined, then it'll definitely get your interest and it'll have enough technical detail to keep you interested. But it's also good for the, you know, the layman.
Yeah, because I could understand about how they were decrypting DVDs or something and then they cracked it. But then the next time they release DVD, or is it a different format? But I'm thinking, hang on a minute, how does that work kind of thing? Because you already cracked the code kind of thing. So
that was the difference between DVDs and Blu-rays. So a DVD has one code, and that is one code forever.
Okay.
Blu-ray players need to have an internet connection, because every time a key is released, the Blu-ray players have to go and get a new one.
All right, okay.
So that's how.
How does it not know it kind of thing? So how does it generate it? That's cool. Thank you for that.
That's all right.
Cool. I think we're near the end of the show, aren't we?
I think so. So there's some things that we like to mention on this show, particularly events that are coming up. There's the Glasgow Pod Crawl on Saturday the 28th of July, and the URL for that's in the show notes. And then there is Og Camp, which is on the 18th and 19th of August in Sheffield, and as I'm one of the organisers for that, I'd like to plug the fact that we're currently running a call for papers. So if you wanted to speak on the main stage at Og Camp, so Og Camp's an unconference, but we like to have a scheduled track that we can publicise in advance. So if you know that there's a talk that you want to give at Og Camp, and you're ready to tell the world about it, please let us know at CFP, that's Charlie Foxtrot Papa, .ogcamp.org, Oscar Golf Golf Charlie Alpha Mike Papa, .org.
Did I hear that Simon Phipps was going to be involved with it?
So Simon Phipps, he runs there's some stuff that's going on in the background. Up until now, Og Camp's always just been run by the organisers. So all the funding goes through the organisers' bank accounts. And rather unsurprisingly, there are tax implications and things like that. And it wasn't a significant amount of money that was going through accounts, but it was enough that certain people that had been doing organizing in the past were a bit anxious about the funding being there. We'd been umming and ahhing about becoming a better organized group, and Simon Phipps and another guy called Andrew Katz organize a community interest company. Essentially, we are Og Camp, this is the first year where we are part of that community interest company. And essentially it means that Simon and Andrew own the books for Og Camp. And essentially what that means is that we are not personally liable for the funds that are going through the books.
Yeah.
So the tax man isn't going to come and ask me what this, you know, £1,000 is that just come in from ticket sales or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, if one of our organisers was, you know, going through financial difficulties, there's a risk that funds might have gone missing. Not that they ever did, and I'm not wishing to say, but, you know, by having this proper formal construct around how Og Camp's there,
yeah,
we've taken some of the risk away from running an Og Camp. And as a result, Simon is more involved in Og Camp this year. We're always keen for anyone that wants to be involved and do things around Og Camp. We are keen for you to be involved in Og Camp. And the fact that Simon, on top of being involved in the books around Og Camp, he is also therefore getting more involved in the organising of things. And so this year we're hoping to see him there as being involved in the organisation of it.
Yeah. I saw him at Fostham. It's good to see him in real life. I've heard him on Floss Weekly And obviously he's a big name in sort of open source world.
Yes.
So, yeah.
I think I owe him a drink from about 4 years ago. So
right.
Be good to see him and pay him back on that one.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so those are the three events that we've got coming up. And as I said, we are running a call for papers for our camp. So if you want to give a talk, please jump on that and submit your talk that you want to give. And obviously, if you don't want to submit it through the call for papers, you just want to turn up and present it, then that's fine as well, because it is an unconference.
Prepare your post-it note now.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you get to be publicised in advance of OggCamp if you put it through the call for papers.
There could even be some kind of voting system, maybe.
Don't talk about my poor defeated scheduling system. So the other thing that I wanted to mention is that once again I'd like to say a thank you to Dave Lee of thebugcast.org for his production services. He's an absolute scholar and a gentleman, and thank you very much, Dave.
He makes us sound very professional, like we do it for a living.
Yeah, and we might even buy a beer for him at our camp.
Maybe.
And maybe a couple more as well.
Good. Okay, so see you all next time, guys. Bye for now.
Cheers. Bye.
Until the next time.